Our second speaker now is Chris Clark of the National Sound Archive of the British Library. He is head of documentation and has been head of it since 1992. Before that, he worked at the National Sound Archive as jazz curator. And he is known for several projects, the Pompey, for instance, the bibliography of pop and jazz articles and periodicals, and an oral history of jazz in Britain, as well as a register of jazz oral history collections.
I left it at home, unfortunately. It was very nice to hear Jerome talk about the institution I joined about 15 years ago, and I hope I'll, in the course of this, I'll explain a few changes that have been made in that institution. I've kind of given a rough title to this presentation. It goes, a cataloguer meets a discographer, each assuming that they're dealing in only in surfaces. Discographical research in sound archives may be conducted in several ways. It may take the form of seeking advice from specialist staff, examining physical items, perhaps even listening to them, reading primary and secondary source material, and consulting the sound archive's own catalogue. And this particular resource, perhaps consulted rather less than we who build them would hope. Well, at this basic service level, things have been changing, not just at the National Sound Archive in London where I work, but more generally thanks to improvements in catalogue automation and networking, so that our catalogues assume not only a more important role as resources for discographical information, but also offer the possibility of producing formatted information quite close to the finished article. You know, in other words, the era of the instant discography may be here. Beyond that, I want to suggest that certain kinds of information that are included in sound archive catalogues and the records within them may add a deeper dimension to the products of discographical research, and let's call it for the moment objective indicators of cultural significance. "What can you do for me?" said the discographer to the cataloguer. Well, the answer given depends really on the system that has been installed and developed. Most cataloguing systems are designed primarily to enable the archive to manage its collections. And at the most basic level, this means finding records for people to listen to. But such is the flexibility and choice of access points available in modern retrieval systems that a wide range of discographical research and preparatory organization is possible, even within the OPAC screens themselves. Beyond that, reports can be produced to meet the most complex of requirements. For example, a discography of all live recordings of symphonic music published on CD. And if the system is networked via PCs, the reports can be downloaded as great slabs of word processor ease, where all manner of reformatting can take place, even as far as the final draft of the discography. Our catalogue will also let you browse and enter partially matching search terms, added the cataloguer excitedly. Well, these, of course, are vital facilities to offer any discographer, for however hard we've worked at applying those rules, inconsistencies occur, and if it is decided to convert old catalogue records, or somebody else include somebody else's records in your own catalogue, you may find that temporarily you have not one form of heading for each term, but many. Should we mind as cataloguers so much in the looser environment of the online system? Within one's own self-contained system, backed up by knowledgeable staff, probably not too much. But the next development for access to sound archive catalogues, and it's something Jerome was mentioning just now, is interoperability, the possibility of accessing several databases simultaneously through an information gateway. And this, of course, will require a lot more attention to be given to the common standards. And you might be interested to know that a European community-funded project, Project Paragon, is aiming to establish a common attribute set, that's a set of data fields, for sound recordings. And this will be and we would encourage this to be added as an extension to the international search and retrieve and American Z39.50 standards. And again, another EC project, Project Jukebox, has created multilingual thesauri for its purpose-built catalogue. And these two things are likely to be features of future networks of sound archive databases to help satisfy the lust for total information. So just how much information do you require, asks the cataloguer. Are you going to be satisfied with a shelf listing, or do you require me to have second-guessed all the needs of your present research topic? Our cross-referencing can be truly impressive. Well, had the discographer been John Cage, not noted for his pronouncements on cataloguing, he might have replied with a quote from his own lecture, "Where are we going and what are we doing?" I quote, "If we set out to catalogue things today, we find ourselves rather endlessly involved in cross-referencing. Would it not be less efficient to start the other way round, after the fashion of some obscure second-hand bookstore?" Unquote. Well, this causes the cataloguer to shudder as he remembers what he's just read about the state of information on the internet, the greatest library in the world, but the books are all over the floor. Cage may have a point. Vast systems of information, however well they're governed, can appear totally random and discontinuous. All discographical research is, to my mind, a variation on the old game of discovering reassurance in continuity. So our work as catalogue makers can be supportive adequately if it includes enough indicators of that continuity, whatever the context. So here's my view of what some of these indicators should be and what requirements they're seeking to satisfy. I would argue that there are essentially three groupings of discographical approach to catalogue information. They'll probably be, and maybe should be, interdependent. The first grouping concerns the voice of the author or composer within the continuity of a career or cultural tradition. The end result would then be a discography of written works. The second grouping concerns the performer in time and space, and by performer I would mean people, groups of people, animals and machines. So it's the voice of the performer, or an instrument even, within the continuity of a performance tradition and within a particular kind of environment. So the end result there would be a discography, some listing of the performer's recording sessions. The third grouping concerns the voice of the producer. And I take that in the broadest sense, not just the guy who's mentioned who produced the record. The voice of the producer within the continuity of field recording, broadcasting, or the recording industry. And the end result of this would be a discography such as a label discography. And I'd like to illustrate just what I mean by all this by playing you three brief recorded extracts and then considering each in turn, considering what information is appropriate for a catalogue to provide. So the first example I'm going to play you is a work by Boulez, which was actually the object of my first visit to the National Sound Archive, as it was the BIRS in those days.
The extreme fragmentation of the first book has given way to a more continuous texture.
Example of what I consider as the first approach, the voice of the author or composer, and it makes really very few demands on any cataloguing system. It requires the author and the work to be identified unambiguously, and a recording of that work to be described. In this case, there was only one recording. More demands are made, though, when the researcher is looking for continuities within the composer's oeuvre, modifications to the composer's original idea, somebody else's arrangement, for instance, or relationships with the work of contemporaries and the tradition in which the composer was working. But since we're dealing here with sounds that have already been recorded, so to speak, as scores or books, our policy for dealing with such continuities can draw on the rules and procedures for cataloguing books, so it then amounts to a decision on detail, dates of birth, full names, publishers, maybe titles in the original language. My second example has put together some different recordings of the jazz standard Caravan. They're versions which have been made over a period of 60 years, and I've spliced them together for a little bit of fun since we've got ASK members present, to make a single recording. Of Caravan, then stretching over a period of 60 years from Duke Ellington's original version to a version by Julian Joseph Big Band at the Proms a few weeks ago with audience participation. Well, this second approach then, the voice of the performer, requires something a bit more sophisticated, differentiating between recordings of the same work, possibly by the same performer, and you heard two versions by Ellington there separated by a period of about 40 years. And to satisfy this discographical requirement, the catalogue must provide dates, recording dates, locations, matrix and take numbers if that's appropriate. And since I regard this information as the most important for identifying a recording, it became the focal point when we came to structure the National Sound Archive's new online catalogue. But without such a focus, you may lose altogether the opportunity for meaningful displays in chronological order. And so the researcher's task will be made so much more difficult, more bothersome. Beyond the description of who, when and where, there's little I suppose our catalogues can or even should try to do to illuminate the research topics suggested by that collage, such as the Latin tinge in jazz, Juan Tizol's contribution to the Ellington Band, Minimal chord movement as a basis for modern jazz, Thelonious Monk's version that you heard there, Caravan as rabble rouser at the proms, can British bang, big band swing, can audiences clap in time? For such research, the discographer kind of takes potluck, I suppose, with whatever versions of the title are listed in the catalogue, but isn't that all part of the fun of research? My final example consists of three products carrying the same recording, which is of the broadcast premiere of Britain's Spring Symphony. First, you'll hear a copy of the original acetate disc, which was taken privately off Hilversum Radio in 1949. Then you'll hear the National Sound Archive's cedarized version of 1992 for its own playback service. And finally, you'll hear Decca's historic release for the devotees of Kathleen Ferrier in 1994, using who knows what noise reduction system. Decca's version. Third approach, then, which I've called the voice of the producer, is probably described by catalogers in more detail than discographers might expect. And we're talking here about information of great significance for the interpretative aspects of discography. If you ignore it, you'll still enjoy the voice, you'll still enjoy that sonata or that improvisation, and you'll complete your list. But you may miss some crucial points about how it was intended to be heard by those who produced it. Very measures of the recording's cultural significance. If we just take that Britain example again, first of all you have the private recording which was intended for the composer's own use, and another copy was made for Lord Harwood, who more or less rediscovered it by accident several years later, gave it to the National Sound Archive, who then cedarized it for a playback, so that in that case it kind of adds value to the National Sound Archive's public listening services. Then that recording was introduced to Decca, who created a new mix for commercial release. You didn't hear it in ideal circumstances, but you probably have noted the deliberate highlighting of Kathleen Ferrier's contribution. So is this a piece of pure commercial opportunism, or is it a culturally significant document? I can't really answer that question here. So here are some of the types of information you'll find at this level. The physical and technical properties of the recording, obviously. But also, who made this recording available and when? Is it legal? Who produced it? Was it sponsored? Did it fulfill the requirements of a thesis or some competition? Was it part of some commemorative series? Who engineered or remastered it? And if it was an old recording, what was done to it to make it more appealing for new audiences? At the National Sound Archive, we've built our catalogue and are developing our public services to meet the requirements of a wide range of users, including discographers. And the test of the possibilities of that system are about to begin. Tomorrow, in fact. to conclude, just let me summarize the main points of this meeting between cataloger and discographer. Online catalogs of sound recordings, if designed with a discographical researcher in mind, can bring the work of the cataloger and discographer into a much closer relationship and make the latter's job much easier, possibly more fun. New possibilities will be provided by linking sound archive catalogues together through information gateways, provided the standards are compatible. And finally, the description of the product, the sound carrier, as purposely manufactured object can dispel the impression that all either the cataloguer or the discographer deals in is surfaces. Thank you.